that listing, and are still in print today, probably it will be more as you interact with them, their personalities, that might either attract or repel. So Athanasius, for example, the grizzly bears in the group would be Athanasius and Shirley Jerome. Jerome was probably the most irascible great theologian in the history of the church, who was always mad at somebody and dissatisfied with somebody, and yet a great scholar and great biblical exegete. Of the group, my favorite is Chrysostom. Part of that is because I did my doctoral work on Chrysostom, and part of it, when you just spend some time with somebody, which is probably the way to go with a lot of these folks, is you just get to know them. And so when he's speaking in a given manner, when it even seems like he's scolding, you know, his personality, you know, why he might be saying something the way he is. I'll share his life with us, you all today a little bit.
Tertullian, would you stay away from him?
No, I wouldn't stay away from him, but again, you have to know what you're dealing with. When you're dealing with somebody like Tertullian, you're dealing with somebody who grew up in North Africa with a Latin background. He's a lawyer. He's come into the church. It's a time of great persecution. The more we can find out about somebody, just like yesterday, the more we can find out about somebody's story, the more accessible they will be to us, and probably the greater the patience we'll have with them. So obviously, just keep in mind some of those tactics that we would use, if I can put it that way, reading tactics that we would use for devotional literature in general. And then it works in theology too. And even when we're getting into the deep water of some of these great theologians, all of them are worth spending time with.
Is there a point in time where you say, well, I would not read Tertullian after this point in time?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No.
You keep reading it to the end.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just like a spiritual discipline for me. Because sometimes I think when I'm most strongly reactive, for example, to what somebody's writing, if they're still in print and the church has said these are voices worth listening to, and I'm getting upset, at that point I'm thinking, well, maybe I'm getting upset because I'm being very directly addressed about something in me. So, Chris, just be quiet for a minute. And let me toss out a rule to the group, and I think it's related to what you were saying. Could you tell me your name?
Dennis.
Yes. What Dennis was saying about sometimes we always want to avoid generalizing and caricaturing, right? But sometimes folks from an evangelical background struggle with something, and either it's we don't know enough to speak, or when we speak, we might know somebody's position, but when we talk about the position, we don't talk about it fairly. So let me toss out a rule. It's called Wolterstorff's rule. Wolterstorff, yeah! Nick Wolterstorff, who was up at Yale, he was in Calvin. This is the rule. And I think maybe even as you're reading the Fathers, you can keep this in mind. It's helped me a lot over the years. In fact, for example, somehow I find myself in environments where frequently I'm debating or dialoguing with people. So I've been involved in a Mormon evangelical dialogue now for a number of years. I was just out at BYU 2 weeks ago with a bunch of Mormon historians and theologians who are really good friends of mine. We talked theology the whole day. And the rule applies to me with them. So if I'm talking about Mormonism to evangelical folk, I have to represent them fairly. That's what the Wolterstorff's rule is about. Related to some of what Daryl was saying in chapel yesterday, Catherine Keller, or a little bit sounded like some of my openness theology friends, like a man named John Sanders. I don't know if you know that name, John Sanders. He wrote a book called The God Who Risks, and so on. Well, John and I have debated about this issue publicly in a gymnasium, for example, at his school, and in college before they fired him. And he moved down to a better school for him, and so on. And we had a book that we did together, which was basically our email exchanges together about this whole idea that he was representing. And we talk about Wolterstorff's rule. Here's what it is. If I'm talking about Tertullian, or Chrysostom, or the Desert Monastic, the rule is Tertullian is sitting here, and I'm talking about Tertullian in Tertullian's presence. The rule is I have only represented Tertullian well if Tertullian, when I'm finished, looks at me, smiles, and says, that is indeed what I believe. That's the rule. So that bridles the tendency within us to want to simply win an argument, but not represent somebody fairly. So if I talk about Mormonism or Joseph Smith or whatever, now I've actually had the experience of talking about these things in the presence of Mormon historians and theologians. And I would never want to represent their beliefs in such a fashion that they would be looking at me, shaking their head, saying, Chris, what are you doing? You know that's not true. Or you know, dot, dot, dot. Rather, I want to see them smiling at me and say, yep, that's what we believe. And at that point, the dialogue can begin. That makes sense? So dealing with ancient documents is a lot like that. So we have to work very hard at building a bridge into these folks' world. And I think just living there, listening, and then asking questions, interacting, trying to break that tendency to react too quickly to a position that initially seems to us to be so foreign, maybe beyond the bounds of orthodoxy and so on. And then there comes a point. There comes a point when we can disagree. All the rule asks is fairness, honesty, and then, if we're going to critique, not to do so out of ignorance, but to offer a fair, honest, well-informed criticism of such a scriptural. I had an experience to share a little bit. I think we got a lot of time today to work through what we're going to work through. I had an experience where I was teaching at Regent College a couple years ago on what we're talking about. In fact, on what we talked about yesterday. And I was having all kinds of fun. Went out to dinner with some acquaintances, how to describe that. And then we were done. I was handed them, at the end of dinner, as we're walking into the parking lot, I was handed them an envelope from one of these folks. And the person handing it to me said, Chris, I'm concerned. And handed me the manila envelope. And I thought, damn. That's what I thought. I said, and Deb's with my wife's with me, and she's saying, don't look at it tonight.
No.
Don't look at it tonight. I said, all right, I won't look at it tonight. And I got back to the apartment, and I looked at it. And what it was a group on the net who were they had listed the voices that you must not listen to.
Yes.
I was at the top of the list. I was at the top of the list. And of course, I really start growling.
I was at the top of the list.
And growling, she says, I told you you should have read before you sleep. And here's what it said. Christopher Hall is teaching Eastern mysticism at Regent College. And I thought, you are an idiot. I don't know anything about Eastern mysticism. I don't know that stuff. And then other people were in the list. I was at the top. But I felt good when Jim Packer was number two. There's groups out there, and I thought, well, that's maybe mad because I thought, that's not fair. Well, we should probably get started in terms of what we want to do today. So this is just a lead-in, simply a lead-in of aspects of what we'll be working through today. And then we'll take a look at Augustine's relationship with Proba on prayer, and the coaching he gives her on prayer. And then this morning we'll take a look at John Chrysostom and some of his thoughts on prayer and providence. And that'll be this morning. This afternoon we'll come back together and we'll be back more in a desert spirituality. Although both Chrysostom and Augustine had been in that environment. We'll come back and we'll talk about John Cashin and one of his conferences, as they're called, an interview that he has with an Abba by the name of Isaac about prayer. And then we'll close up the day asking, all right, now what are the implications for the work that we've done together for the world in which we live? How can we build an effective bridge? And then what I'm going to ask you to do is take some time, and then we'll interact together about takeaways you're going to have from the time we spent together that we can share with one another. And that will be pretty much the day. Okay? So, anyway, that first bullet point of prayer is a life offered to God. That expanded understanding of prayer, that widening of prayer, comes from Origen. And I really like that. I think sometimes we can be burdened by thinking of prayer as an activity that we have to do here in a certain way at a certain time. And in reading Origen, he helped me at that point by saying, offer your life to God. And as we offer our life to God on a daily basis, almost hourly, that offering in itself is prayer. And maybe that'll come up again today. But when we are with Cashin this afternoon, we'll talk a little bit about what this wordless contemplative prayer is. It's a way of seeing the wonder of God that's an inexpressible, wordless kind of reality. It's a little bit like what I was just touching on at the commencement. What was that saying? Where you see something and it's so beautiful and so wondrous and so indescribable, ineffable, can't be captured in words, that you're drawn out of yourself to that reality, and it's like you live there. It's a state that the monks were very interested in, and Isaac's very interested in his conference with John Cashin. And daily office, these folks are always praying the Psalms. Some of these monastic communities, they were praying all 150 psalms every day. And then it became the common practice every week in almost all monastic communities. And then we'll take a look at Psalm 70, verse 1. Lord, make speed to save me. Oh God, make haste to help me. That's a very, very important psalm and verse in this kind of monastic spirituality, patristic spirituality. We'll see why when we get to that point. Okay, so that's just kind of outline of sorts for the day. Now, I know this is kind of busy, and if you download it, you're getting angry with me. If you download it, the memory stick from yesterday, you'll see that I expanded this a little bit. Sorry. I was reading and thinking last night, and I thought, I'm going to be a little bit more helpful, I think. So what we want to do then is for the remaining part of this first hour together to enter into the relationship that Augustine has with Proba. Let me tell you a little bit about Proba. Proba was a Christian widow, Roman background, living in solitude, in likelihood on her villa, a wealthy Roman Christian widow who had written a letter to Augustine asking him specific questions about prayer. It's amazing to me with some of these fathers, I don't know how they did it, because Augustine's preaching three or four times a week. He's writing line after line after line after line. then his correspondence, his willingness to give himself to so many people in such details, very striking. And most of the fathers were like that. Even the grizzly bears. Sister, they might growl back at you rather than hug you. So she asked for coaching from Augustine on prayer. He responds around 412 AD. So he's looking at a human life, looking at the life of a friend. The friendship is very important to Augustine. And so it's interesting to me the five or six things he tells her as she asks about prayer. And one of the first things out of his mouth has to do with death. What he's concerned about is that the wealth that she possesses, and from his perspective, the ease of life that wealth has created for her, he's concerned that the result will be prayers that are skewed. So the first thing that he says to her is, I want you to think about your death. I want you to think that you might die tomorrow. And in light of that contemplation, that meditation, he asks the question, how would that form and then shape your prayers and your perspective on prayer? And that request, he's fairly blunt, that request is one that reappears throughout classical Christian spirituality. When I was sitting up in front listening to the different students and what they did for their thesis, I thought I heard one that was on the art of dying, Ars Moriendi. Did I hear something like that?
Yes. Yeah.
So one on the art of dying, and then the role that memento mori had in the Christian tradition, remembrances of death, a remembering of death. Some kind of object that Christians would have in their home to remind them, you know, you're not going to be around forever. Life is very fleeting. Remember that. In Puritan homes, for example, on a shelf, they would either have a skull or a fake skull. And you'd walk in and you'd think, geez, what's that all about? Well, they're just remembering. And the idea is that we will pray better and live better if we remember that our days are fleeting. That this gift of years that God gives to us goes by very quickly. That we'll see differently. It's not meant to be morbid or discouraging, but it's meant to be real. Here's what happened to me in God's providence. I was running with somebody on the track team at UCLA, and we used to run from LA down to the ocean. He was a steeplechaser by the name of Neil Cyber. I just call him Cyber. And we were running down there, and one day, we were both about 21. It's our junior year. And we're trying to figure out, what are we going to do this summer? We've got to make some money this summer. Well, in L.A., as you're running, all the bus benches in L.A. Advertise funeral homes. I had never, ever seen anybody who was dead. I'd never seen a dead body in my life. So Cyber's running along, and he sees these benches, and he says, it's got to be quiet. There couldn't be a lot to do. That's what we should do. And I said, you are crazy. I don't want to work at a funeral home. No. And he just, yeah. And then, of course, Tom thinks, why don't you want to work in a funeral home? Are you afraid? That kind of thing. I can still remember the tone of his voice. It's very nervous. And so sure enough, he starts phoning up funeral homes. So for, I think it was well nigh 2 years, I worked for Last Bad Willen, California's largest Jewish mortuary. God's truth. And I was what they call the first call man. I drove a black ambulance at the age of 21. And my job was sleep, get a phone call, this is in North Hollywood, right next to the Pussycat Theater. And we'd wait, and the phone would ring, and something had happened somewhere in L.A. And during coroner's month, it was especially lively because because the coroner's department only has so many cases. They can't handle them all, and so coroner's monthly responsibility is to get involved in murders, suicides, and accidents. So I'm 21 years old. Can you imagine? 21 years old, and my life is suddenly engaged in a reality that I had never thought about very deeply. And I never knew what to expect. And I think God providentially put me there. I only lasted about 2 years, finally, I said, that's it. But over those 2 years, and lots of very, I have to tell you, very hard contact with a side of life that I had avoided because I didn't want to think about it. And saw things that I still remember. And I'm thankful for that experience. In some ways, there's some aspects of the job I wish I hadn't seen, but it was there for a reason. And I know that it's formed and shaped how I think about these kinds of things. It was as though the Lord said, son, I'm going to allow you to see some things, touch some things, smell some things, look at some things, and you're going to have to go deeper than you've been with me. Because this is the world. This is the world in which you live. This is life between the times. And I want you to grow up. And it's affected. It's interesting. I don't think that I've become a sad, morose person. Kind of crazy. Always have been. But it's helped me to remember, Chris, you only have so many years. You only have so many years. They're a gift from God. Live accordingly, pray accordingly. And that's what one of the first things that Augustine says to grow up. Because he's afraid that the comfort level in her life might lead into self-deception in prayer, with the result being skewed prayer. Makes sense? That's a concern for the fathers. And it will come up again and again. They're not reluctant to talk about the hard things. The kinds of things that do keep you up at night. The kind of things you wonder about. And then, all right, now I don't see. What it did for me was I couldn't say, life's always wonderful. Let's pray accordingly. It was more like, Lord, sometimes my prayers were, Lord, are you having an off day? Some memory lapse. These two cars, give me one more second. They wouldn't have hit. Didn't you know about that person who was going to put that pistol in his mouth? Take his life? Oh, you're 21, that's a lot to wrap your mind around. So none of that stuff I look at as a gift in and of itself, but what it produced in a young human life, trying to figure out who God is and what it means to be in relationship with God. It meant a lot. And it's the same thing with Proba and Augustine. He wants to introduce Proba into what he would call reality. And then allow the wonder of Christ also to move into reality, be light between the times, where you just cry your eyes out sometimes, and allow that reality to be formed and shaped into, in some ways, a cruciform pattern. So, for instance, sometimes with my students, I'll talk like this to them, and when you're 18, you don't believe it, or you don't want to talk about it. And I'll use a line like, well, you know, as far as I can tell, we're going to bury everybody that we love. Or we'll go first. But it looks to me like that. And then at 8:30 in the morning, when you get to me, you're just going, what? What did you just say? But it's that, if we can do this gently with great love and sensitivity, it helps us, and I think it helps us. Young people to move to a new place. I think sometimes what the fathers do for people is they help them to look at something they don't want to look at. And and then to learn to pray in light of what they're seeing. So, number three here, the fathers will talk about this a lot. And Thomas and Clerica, Sarah, same thing, the difference between a pilgrim and a settler. So the idea of being on a journey and the perspective of someone who's a pilgrim, where we're a traveling light, not burdened, moving towards home, not there yet, is important for these writers. And when they think of prayer, they think that the prayers of a pilgrim will be different from the prayers of a settler. The lay of the land looks differently to a settler than to a pilgrim. Travel light. And I can remember distinct instances in that job that I had where that hit home. I remember there was what we call the John Doe, who died actually in the Pussycat Theater, bless his heart. And we buried him. And I was the one handling things that evening, and I can remember that the folks were trying to keep him there, and thinking like a settler, and I looked into his casket, and there was a bottle of Jack Daniels somebody had put in there, there was a Q-stick, they were just loading him up for the journey. And the Christian, from Augustine's perspective, is moving towards home, but not there yet. So how would our prayers be effective if such is indeed the case? So I want to say, we're home, but don't we all know that we're not? So that's about the first quarter to half of this discourse he has with her. And then the question arises, what is the source of true happiness? Now think this through with me. Why is he here's what he's interested in. He's going to encourage Proba and her relationship with God to make requests. Petitionary prayer, making of requests, intercessory prayer, interceding on the behalf of somebody else, is very important for the fathers. But he's worried about the kinds of requests a human being might make. And he thinks there's some kinds of requests that are good, some kinds of requests that might be what he would call disorder. So he begins to talk to her about happiness. And he's worried about false happiness. And he's high on what he calls true happiness. So happiness, from his perspective, and he's Greek at this point, happiness has to do with what's good. What's good? That's the first thing. Happiness, secondly, has to do with loving the good, being drawn toward the good, wrapping one's mind and heart around the good. Third thing, the good is often difficult, hard. So the danger is, that's a little pedigree, that's the moving it into a Christian perspective. He would say, now here's the problem. Human beings have been touched by evil. Human beings have been touched by evil. You remember that Latin phrase I used before? Human beings are incubatus in se. And what that means is, even for Christians like me, for Christians like you, the danger is that we can misidentify what happiness is. That we can misidentify what goodness is. And our prayers then will arise out of what he would call disordered affections. It's a given for him and for almost every patristic writer.
human beings left to themselves will love the wrong things. They'll misidentify. We left to ourselves will misidentify what good is. So, we run into the issue, for example, in the United States, it's a deeply materialistic culture, it's a consumerist culture, the idea being, if I attain the good life, it will mean that I'm materially prosperous, right? Materially prosperous. A home, house, I don't know, car, cash in the bank, kids in school, all of those things. And the result will be, if I pursue that good and attain that good, then I will be happy. So the bumper sticker, every father would hate this bumper sticker, but the bumper sticker, he who dies with the most toys wins. They would respond, no, he who dies with the most toys is dead. And I can distinctly remember looking for a body once. It came home. Oh, gosh, it was so strong. I was in a big war in L.A., and we guys from some other establishment were there before me in Cyber. And we walked in, and there had to be, you know, 50 to 100 bodies on slabs, stacked, right? With toe tags. And then they walked out, and they thought it was funny. The door clicked, and they turned off the light. So we're trying to find a light switch. Plus, we're trying to find who we're looking for. And you know what came home to me is this, the young guy? We finally found a light switch. It was kind of an adventure. We found a light switch, and then we're looking for who we're supposed to transport. And I was looking at these toe tags, and it was so striking to me. Some people very well known. Other people, John Doe. They were all the same. All the same. Their story was over. And the danger with what he would say with false happiness or false loves is you never attain or gain what you're looking for. It's not there. It's a disordered false happiness. So he's looking at Probus, and we gotta talk about this. You know, I love you, but we gotta talk about this because this is a danger. 18, 19 years ago, when I was just out of my doctoral work, the way I kept fed for a year was to write a book for the Templeton Foundation in Philadelphia on the effect of religion on health. Are religious people more healthy than non-religious folks, and so on? And what was interesting in some of the studies that I looked at is that the level of life satisfaction amongst the wealthy is lower than the level of life satisfaction among the poor. Poverty is no gift, but the level of life satisfaction is lower amongst the wealthy in the United States. Those who win the lotto, their level of life satisfaction decreases rather than increases. I had a hard time swallowing that one. That would be heading to work and traveling on the train, and that would take me to the train, and I'm the opposite. Love having a car, and I see the lotto, and I say, Lord, I know if I would win it, I would be the exception to the rule. Just a small fortune. I can tell you, it's really about the book. Just a small fortune. Now, so if you take a look here, then this is what I think we really do need to think through. False happiness, false love. What is the good life? I'd like you to ponder that. Take that back to your students if you're teaching somewhere. Explore that. What is goodness? What is good life? And what he will argue and what Chrysostom will argue is that the good life is often cruciform.
See, they become, at that point, they become Christological. We'll see this in our next hour. Who, from their perspectives, who led the highest, most holy, most good life in human existence? Christ did. What characterizes that life in terms of how he chose to live and what characterizes his experience? See how that would make sense to grow by faith? If Augustine's coaching, she says, now, life can be cruciform in its nature, the way that Pope will be praying would be along that line. She won't be caught off guard if persecution occurs or on her time martyrdom passed in terms of blood, what we might call blood martyrdom, other kinds of martyrdom in the church at that time. The way that she will pray will be different. It might be for perseverance, strength, courage, deep love, compassion for the poor, and so on. See how that works? So the key here, is the issue of true love versus false love. A disordered will versus a healed will. Redeemed affections versus skewed affections. Bottom line, what do we love? Are we loving the good as created by Christ with an underlying and overarching cruciform pattern? Or not? The antithesis of this perspective would be something like the prosperity gospel. And I don't want to misrepresent the prosperity gospel, but if the prosperity gospel is saying, come into a relationship with Christ, you'll be blessed, and the result will be material prosperity, I don't think that works. But the reason I don't think it works is I don't think it fits reality, the reality of life between the times, or the fundamental model pattern given to us by Christ. Now then the question becomes, so he comes, I find this to be the top of it. Imagine me on the freeway. I once lost a whole funeral procession by that. That was bad. I got out, everybody keeps going. I thought, I cannot be good. Because she needs coaching. If she's thinking, and she's extremely bright, she'd be thinking, all right, that's great. What's the good life? Where is genuine happiness to be found? Yes, I am a wealthy Roman matron. What principle, overarching principle, can I use in terms of how I should spend my money? What I should ask for in prayer? And everyone would say, I can hear Basil, I can hear Gregory of Nazianzus, I can hear Augustine. They always say necessity, need. Beyond that, you're robbing somebody else. They can be very direct at that point. Necessity, need. Of course, right, at that point, I say in response, oh, that's helpful. How much is need? When do I cross the line from need and necessity into self-indulgence or what they would call luxury? That's something we just have to work on. Communally, I would probably argue. So that's one of the key points for him as he's coaching her. See what he's doing? He's trying to help her form a Christological lens for looking at the nature of goodness and human happiness with the result that her petitions match up with God's desire for the world itself. So he's insisted at this point right there, regarding me that she think that one through. And if she crosses that line between need into indulgence or luxury, he would not be happy. But none of these folks would be happy at that point. And I think about that. And I ponder these questions. But what we don't, can you see how the issue of self-deception would come in here? That we were talking about some detail yesterday. Oh, because I can convince myself, believe me, I can convince myself that I really need something. Oh, I need it. I need it so bad. I mean, and I need it now. And then I hear these voices saying, now hold off a minute here. Let's think that one through. So one of the challenges, maybe one of the takeaways for all of us will be to maybe last hour we have together, think that one through a little bit together, that or in the future. Take this way of looking at reality in the world. What's the nature of true happiness? What's the nature of true goodness? The danger of it, because we're still infected with a contagion that will cause our affections and will, our minds still to be distorted. With those dangers, how can we communally live more effectively before God regarding these very practical issues that will affect how we pray? So he talks about it, and then he says, but there are some other things. So the principle is the principle of necessity, the principle of need. But then he'll talk about issues. He says, it's fine to pray. Pray. God, keep me safe. That matches up with reality. He's not a masochist. Keep me safe. Keep me safe on the road. Keep me safe when I travel. Deliver me from physical illness. Augustine firmly believed, for example, in physical healing. The city of God, he'll say, if I were to describe to you all the miracles that have taken place in St. Stephen's, I run out of paper. So pray for our needs. Give us this day our daily bread. Pray for personal safety. Pray for our friends, and that we might have friends, you know, as we navigate life.
That isn't too much different than Maslow's hierarchy of needs. The psychologist, I remember I just looked that up. I remember reading that. Maybe he copied.
Can you help me? What would Maslow's hierarchy of needs be? What is it?
Safety. Food.
Safety, food, shelter.
They've got love and belonging, esteem. He leaves out the God part, but the basic fundamentals are the same.
Interesting. Think about it. So we have the need for friends. Love of neighbor. And then, though I've listed these in this order, he would argue, and he does with Proba, that love of God is the source of healthy relationships to all of these other things. I will, as I grow in my love for God, I'll have a clear understanding of what my needs genuinely are. Issues regarding personal safety, if I can learn to trust God more deeply and be frank and open with God about concerns here. I used to have a phobic response to flying. That's a problem when you're going to fly up. I'm not talking about just, this kind of makes me nervous. I'm talking about a phobic response to flying. Where you sit down in an airplane and it's one continuous silent scream. Take a sigh while you're sitting at this hop. If I didn't get on a plane, and I was supposed to be in Bangkok with a group of about 40 people. It was in 1999, so I got someone said, that's right. All right, what's going on here? Why are you having trouble trusting at this point? What is there about being on an airplane, Chris? Does it have to do with control? Could be. Does it have to do with that past, with that job that you had? Where you saw what can happen to people? All those kinds of issues. But you have people with that kind of phobic response, because it has to do with a lot of these issues, does it not? trust, God, all of those things.
There was a demon on the plane.
There was a demon on the plane? That I don't know. I know there was a scared person on the plane. So, here's the... Here's the overarching principle that, if I can put it that way, for the coaching that you will give her. I might have typed this in, so it might not be on the ones that you're looking at from yesterday. Quote, if we wish for ourselves and our families only what is sufficient for the necessities of life, this sufficiency is not an improper desire, and whoever wishes this and nothing more. And the language he uses is very careful. He's a skilled theologian. So he includes us individually, families, and this idea of sufficient. Period. What is sufficient here is sufficiency for the necessities of life. And having to kind of lay this in terms of how he thinks, then the idea of desires is very important. And we can trust our desires in prayer. Catch it now. We can trust our desires in prayer the more deeply we're formed and shaped into the image of God. Skewed affections will slowly wither. Our understanding will clarify. And the exercise of our will in response to our desires and the petitions we make for ourselves and the intercessions we make for others will be clarified. To speak like an Abba, discernment or discretion will be the result. So if you were with one of the eighth grade doctors for lunch or an Abba from the desert, they would probably, for the first part of the conversation, just really listen. And then they would try to come up with a framework for change. And in her case, because she asked about prayer, his response is formed and shaped. And I think it's pretty good. It's pretty good. The question, of course, that I would have for her is, all right, that's great to talk about need and sufficiency. What does that look like? So, as you listen to him coaching Provo, what do you think of? Yeah.
One thought I had on the number three, if you're building a settler, think about transient society, part of ministry effectively is being in one place a long time. So, how do you?
Yeah. So part of effective, we have a transitory society. Part of effective ministry is being in one place for a long time. So question that is.
So how do you be a pilgrim and settle?
Oh, I see. Yeah, how do you be a pilgrim and settle? You stay in one place, the vow of stability. Remember that from yesterday? But with the perspective of a pilgrim. Even in that one place, you're traveling light. And hopefully we're modeling something for someone else in that light. It's hard. Isn't it? I find that's the hardest thing because I had never owned a house until 6 years ago. And then I got these, maybe a little bit longer, and then I got these crazy jobs and suddenly I could afford a house. And then I see, you know, I've got more stuff. How did that happen? There's a part of me thinking, did I really need it? Oh, I did. I did it real bad. Now, that's the challenge. For most of us, I don't want to overgeneralize, but most of us, compared to the rest of the world's population, are extremely wealthy. And so that's the challenge for me to think. If you were thinking, let me ask you this question. We've got about five minutes. If you were thinking then with him the issue of necessity or need, or you were to coach me, what would you say? What would need look like in a human life in North America?
Well,
How would you go, how would you adjudicate the decisions that we need to make at that point? Is there some kind of concrete response called for, is there not? Well, let's come up with, all right, take 2 minutes to write this down. Then I'm going to ask you, take 2 minutes and write down what might you coach at that point in determining necessity or need. Yeah, take 2 minutes. Beginning now. All right, so let's fire away. Fire away, yeah.
If I remember correctly what you said yesterday, you said the outcome, the final outcome of all of it is to put the Son of God and love of neighbor or love of others. So in answer to your question about determining necessities, I would have to place that as a priority in determining what is necessary. So connecting the how you love God and how you love others and what you have should make a difference.
Yeah, that's good. So they intersect with the question of love of God, love of neighbor. Does that be the framework of making a given decision? Other folks, just take a look at what you wrote. Fire away.
I stole your idea from yesterday that this year I would need just a little bit less than last year.
Oh, yeah. That's really good. From you, not from you.
It's your idea.
No, but the idea of less. Small steps towards less. I like that idea. Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking of, and that's a really good practical way of approaching things. I was thinking along those lines of an Abrahamic covenant of, if I own this item, if I choose to own this item, purchase whatever it is, that will it be part of a framework of blessed to be a blessing, or just free to be me kind of contract? Whatever God, because wealth in Scripture is often a blessing under that covenant idea. I know I can dash.
No, but I think that's fair. I think there's a time for extravagance, celebration. Someone gets married. It's a time for extravagance and celebration. I would. Having said that, the gentleman told Paul it would probably be necessity and need.
I was trying to figure out a way that I could still keep internet access. But ended up saying, what must you have in order to advance the kingdom in the way that you've been asked?
I like that too. So we look at our vocation, we look at the extension of the kingdom of God. What do I need in order to make fulfill my vocation? That was, is that Gordon?
Yes.
And it was interesting, Gordon yesterday was saying that any number of things that you don't need, like a cell phone and so on. But your wife has a cell phone, but probably not the top-of-the-line cell phone. But you're thinking through that issue of what do I need in order to live well before God. Fist fights break out in my class at Eastern. When I purposely will say to students, I want you to talk to each other about something. And at Eastern, we get a wide grouping of students, left wing, right wing, you know, and so on and so forth. By the time I ask this question, I know who's who. So I'll say to the left-wing students, I'll say, all right, you. You must defend the proposition that before God, it is a good thing to drive Mercedes-Benz. And I'll say to the other folks, and you must defend the proposition that it is a sin against God to drive a Mercedes-Benz. And I just release them on each other. And it's really good. And what it does is it brings to the surface these kinds of key issues. Key issues to work through, think through. Yeah.
You know, the church should speak from the authority and integrity of asking the same question. I really believe that.
So the church should be asking these kinds of questions.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they're to be taken with a high degree of seriousness. So, for example, my assistant got me, she's so much smarter than me, and she got me an iPhone. An iPhone 4. So I'm unless you worked it out with replacing the phone I had, it's a certain price, whatever. And it's cut the time I spend on email by 50%. But it was a little bit more expensive. Again, those kinds of principles that we need to think through is if we look to live well and pray well before God. Living well and praying well before God, that would be one piece for these folks. If you remember what Origen said at the beginning of our time together, prayer is a life lived well before God. So why don't we take a break? I'm just watching the time here. And then let's take 15 minutes, and then we'll spend some time at Christmas 7 in the second hour. We'll even move back to some of these same issues.